Chapter 1.
Through Brannan Pike's slow-walking mind, thoughts stole like foggy ghosts. Death came. He felt cold, lying on something soft, something weightless. Death came, whispering. Cold, yes, but not soft, not lying on anything. Death came, whispering orders. Just hanging in zero-G, he realized drowsily, hanging in the dark, with something glowing faintly red off to one side. Those words about death, whispering, seemed familiar somehow. Then he remembered. It was poetry, something that Dervla had been singing yesterday. Then Pike awoke with a curse on his lips as it all came back in a black, bitter rush. The rendezvous with Khor, the handover, the sleep gas ambush, and now here he was in some shadowed corner of the Scarabus where he spun lazily amid a cloud of angular objects that caught faint red glimmers from a solitary emergency lamp over the hatch.
"Wait,"
he said, voice hoarse in a dry throat. Nothing happened.
"Scar, can you hear or respond?"
Silence reigned in the gloom, which meant that the comms and or the AI was offline. Pike coughed, swallowed, and realized he was in Auxiliary Hold 3, the place where they stored stuff that wasn't pointless and wasn't crucial but might be later. A variety of containers, plastic, card, and fabric, drifted all around, some agape and surrounded by their contents, components, silver-wrapped edibles, unidentifiable disc things webbed together in tangled nets. Trade goods, maybe.
"Well," he thought, "still most definitely alive. But why would that pusbag Khor do that? Why leave behind witnesses that could identify him?"
His imagination provided a variety of answers in shades of sadism and horror, and it was impossible not to think about the rest of the crew, Dervla especially. He had to get out of here, find out what had happened, whatever it was. Several unsecured storage straps hung from the ceiling, drifting like strands of plaslong kelp. He stretched out and caught one with his fingertips, drew it into his hand, then hauled himself up to the ceiling and used the sling loops to get to the nearest bulkhead. Loose boxes and tubes and bags hung in his way, reminding him of the number of times he'd asked Ansel to sort through this guddle and clear out the really useless tat. Racks lined the bulkhead. Pulling himself across them, he steered towards the hatch, anchored himself with the metal handle, and prodded the panel of touch controls. As expected, they were dead, so he reached down and twisted the manual release. The door seal popped, and he felt a brief but definite puff of air as pressures equalized. Wedging his arm between the hatch handle and the doorframe, he slowly forced the unlocked hatch open. With a sigh of relief, he floated out into the ship's starboard passageway, glanced either way, and saw the same emergency light shedding meagre red halos amid the murk. There were no sounds, just a muffled quiet. He hooked one arm around a wall stanchion and paused to think back. The trade rendezvous had been set for the environs of a snowbound world called Nadisha 2. In an unexploited system right on the border between Earthsphere and the Indrama Solidarity. The Scarabus had been in orbit for over an hour when Khor's vessel finally arrived. The meeting had taken place in the Scarabus's main hold, and was Pike's first face-to-face with the client. Over subspace comms, Khor had claimed to be the descendant of high-grav workers, but in the flesh he was clearly much more. Humanoid in appearance, though possibly lab-coded for what headhunters referred to as non-civilian applications. Garbed in worn, leathery body armour, Khor was easily 7 feet tall, bald, and had a fighter's brawny physique, as did his two slightly less imposing henchmen. With the body armour and the heavy boots, They resembled extras from the set of an exceptionally ultra-gothic glow actioner. Pike had taken the usual precautions. Apart from Puncho and Hamadi, the rest of the crew were on hand to provide the deterrence of an armed welcoming committee. Khor and his men had climbed out of their squat shuttle and strode leisurely over to where Pike stood next to a waist-high crate on which sat the merchandise, resting within its shaped padding, a state-of-the-art mil-grade subspace scanner caster. When the three stopped, a few feet short and crossed their arms, Pike had heard one of Dervla's trademark derisive snorts from behind. Ignoring it, he had given a bright smile.
"Well now, here we are, meeting at last. Very nice."
Khor, faced like granite, grunted. His dark eyes had flicked right and left at the rest of the crew for a moment before fixing on Pike again.
"This is a device."
Pike gave the scanner's case an affectionate pat.
"You see before you Sagramore Industries' latest and finest scanner, factory fresh and field ready, conveyed to your waiting hands by my professional services, which don't come cheap."
Khor nodded, reached inside his heavy jacket, and produced a small flat case, just the right size for holding a number of credit splines. He held them out and waited until Pike's fingers were prying at the release button before saying,
"Here is your payment."
Now, floating weightless in the half-lit passage, Pike remembered how his danger sense had quivered right at that moment, but his hands had had a life of their own and were already opening the small case. A faint mist had puffed out, and even though he had turned his face away from it, he still caught a whiff of something sweet. He had felt cold prickles scamper across his face as he turned to shout a warning, but saw Ansel and Wynne crumpling to the deck a second before grey nothing shut down his mind. "And yet, I'm still alive," he thought.
"And that skagpile Khor really doesn't seem like the type to leave behind loose ends."
Grabbing handholds on the bulkhead, he launched himself along the passage towards Auxiliary Hold 4. He slowed and floated over to the hatch window, gazed in and swore at the sight. Hamadi's corpse hung there, adrift amid blue and green spares boxes. Dead. The jutting tongue and noticeably bulging eyes spoke of suffocation by depressurization, gradual, not explosive. Otherwise there would have been webs of burst blood vessels and more grotesque damage. Hamadi had been, chief engineer, a genius in his own way, who had made the Scarabus's drive sing like a chorus of harmonized furies. But all Pike could think about was Dervla.
"Dear God, please no."
Pike pushed away from the hatch, turning towards a side opening, the midsection lateral corridor which led to the port side passageway and the other auxiliary holds. He launched himself along it, driven to get it over with. The quiet was eerie, unnerving. No mingled background murmur of onboard systems, no whisper of AC, no low hum of micropumps, no faint sounds of crew activities, no music, no chattering news feeds. Just a numbed silence. But the air, he sniffed, breathed in deep, and realized that it was not as stale as it should be. Some backup ventilation had to be running somewhere, but how and why? More unanswered questions. It was just as gloomy over in the port side passage. From the T-junction, he glided across to Auxiliary Hold 2, grabbed the door stanchion and peered in through the hatch window. There was movement, and the surprised bandito-moustached face of Ansel Martel glanced up from where he floated, crouched next to the manual override panel.
"Hey, Chief!"
came his muffled voice.
"It's jammed on this side! Can you..."
Pike nodded, pried aside the outer panel, and after several sharp tugs, the hatch seal gave with a familiar pop. A moment later, the hatch was slid aside enough for Ansel to squeeze through.
"Those ratbags chumped us, Chief."
"I know.
But why are we still alive?"
Pike ground his teeth and shook his head. Hamadi's in Hold 4, dead from air evac. I think that's what that Gouger Corps had in mind for us all, to be in our quarters and dead from some massive failure of the environmentals. Something must have interrupted the scum, or he just made a bollocks of it and didn't know. He glanced along at the next hatch. What about Hold 1? Do you know if there's anyone in there? Ansel shrugged.
Only came around a short while ago. Banged on the wall a few times, but I didn't hear anything.
Better find out then, haven't we?
So saying, he pushed off along to Hold 1's hatch, grabbed its handle, and swung in close to the window and,
feckin' damn it,
he snarled. Inside, near the rear bulkhead, the bulky, brown-overalled form of Krefom, the Henkaian heavy weapons specialist, drifted a few feet off the deck, still as a statue, sightless eyes gazing out of that craggy, impassive face. In Pike's mind, he imagined Khor and his men moving through the ship, dragging the unconscious crew along, imprisoning them one by one.
That son of a bitch is going to pay!
With the last rage-filled word, he slammed one palm and upper arm against the flat bulkhead, making a sudden loud bang which reverberated along the passage. Then he gasped as he saw the Henkaian's still form jerk convulsively, eyes staring wildly around him for a moment or two. Then he spotted the disbelieving Pike and Ansel at the window, gave a big grin, and pointed.
He was sleeping, Pike said. Sleeping with his eyes open.
A frowning Ansel shrugged.
Maybe Henkaians can do that, Chief. I've never seen him asleep.
Then Krefom was at the hatch, knocking on the window with a big knuckly fist.
Can't open this side, Captain, sir,
came his deep, rough voice.
Broke the emergency handle. Sorry.
We can crack it from here, Kref, Pike said.
Moments later, the lock seal was released, and Krefom pushed the hatch aside with a single push of one mighty forearm. As the big Henkaian shouldered out of the hold, he gave a gravelly chuckle and slapped palms with Ansel. Pike intervened before they started swapping stories.
Kref, I need to know what you have stashed in that cabinet up by the crew quarters.
Some good stuff. Shock batons, trankers, concussion and smoke nades, some light body armour.
The Henkaim frowned for a moment.
And a tangler. You think them skaghats is still on board, Captain Sir?
Dunno, Kref, he said, but I'll not be taking any chances. Let's go.
Together, they floated back along the lateral corridor to the midpoint, where a panel was yanked out to reveal an interdeck access shaft. Pike went first, hand over hand, up the cold alloy ladder. Near the top, where a hatch led to an alcove near the crew quarters, he heard voices and slowed. He made a silencing gesture to Ansel and Kref below him, while listening intently. One voice was female, and after a moment he smiled, recognising the unflappably sardonic tones of Wynne Foskell, their tactics and close combat expert. Pike proceeded to snap open the hatch catches without trying to mute the noise, then gripped a ladder rung and pushed the hatch upwards.
Stop right there,
came Wynne Foskell's voice.
Surrender your weapons. Toss them out. No smart moves, or I'll drop something down that shaft that'll fry you from the inside.
What would that be? Pike said. One of those grip buggers from the galley.
Ansel laughed further down as Pike pushed himself up and into the corridor. A rueful Wynne tilted her tranker away and nodded, then grinned as Ansel was next to emerge. Her glittered dreads wavered as she drifted over to him. Out in the corridor proper, Pike found Mojag, a skinny human, Punjo the Agetzi, and Dervla, who seemed oddly calm when her eyes settled upon him. He was about to ask how she was, but there was something in her features, in fact something in the demeanour of them all. Then he realised what was wrong. Three humans, one Agetzi, but no portly, middle-aged reptiloid Kiskashin. "Where's Oleg?" he said abruptly, even as he guessed. Dervla floated over to him, grey eyes staring intensely from her pale face, her back-tied red hair looking almost black in the redness of the emergency light. She leaned in close and kissed him. "That's for being alive," she said. Then, with disconcerting suddenness, she slapped him. "And that's for Mojag, because he's far too polite." "So, you thought you'd take it upon yourself to act in his stead, is that it?" Her gaze was full of smouldering anger, but Pike could see the hurt behind it. Oleg had been Mojag's co-partner. But in the 4 years since they joined the crew, Dervla had built up bonds of friendship with the Kiskashin.
"You led us here, Bran," she said.
"Where is he?"
Pike said.
"And it was your idea. Your deal."
"Where?"
Before she could answer, Mojag spoke from where he floated further along the darkened passage.
"Our cabin,"
he said in a quiet voice.
"They must have sealed him in there, then set the environmentals to evacuate. I don't know if he knew what was going on, but when the temperature and pressure fell, the hibernation reflex must have taken over."
Mojag breathed deeply for a moment and rubbed his face.
"He looks peaceful. He was probably in hibernation fugue when the air ran out."
"But they could only do that if they got into the enviro controls first," said Ansel,
who then paused and snapped his fingers.
"The auxiliary's in the main hold."
Pike nodded, anger leashed.
"You're right.
Wouldn't be any of them still aboard, would there?"
said Ansel.
"No. Once the deed was done, the filthy Galgers would have left us for dead and scarpered. Although we better be sure."
By now, the crew were gathered round, listening.
"So what we're going to do is this. Empty that armory cabinet, make sure everyone's got something harmful and a torch, and maybe some armor. Then we split up. Two groups, one sweeping the ship from bows to stern, while the other heads for engineering to see about getting the power and the environmentals back up and running. Okay? Let's get to it."
The crew seemed subdued, faces masked with somberness and something else. Sorrow over the loss of Hamadi and Oleg, certainly, but Pike could sense some kind of reserve. Perhaps Dervla wasn't the only one laying blame at his door. The armory cabinet had only been partially looted. Unearthed from a carry case was a solitary pulse stunner, which Kref passed to Pike, who looked it over, checked the charge, then pulled out the extendable stock, locking it in place. It was an ugly, stubby weapon, done up in a horrible mud-brown colour scheme, but for shipboard skirmishing, it was highly effective. Pike chose Kref and Wynn to go with him to engineering, while the others accompanied Dervla forward to start at the bridge. The Scarabus was a small ship, yet the journey back along gravelless, low-lit passages to the aft section was tense, almost nerve-jangling. Pike's group checked from the main hold back to the storerooms, the little machine shop, the lower and upper generators, and the aft maintenance niches, ending up at last in the narrow, split-level chamber that served as engineering control. It had taken 20-odd minutes, and Dervla's group arrived just moments after them.
"Nothing,"
she said, balancing a black-handled shock baton on her shoulder. "Not a sign, not a sound, not a soul."
"Just as well," said Pike. "Then, first order of business is getting the gravity back on. Ansel, you think you can manage that?"
Ansel screwed one eye half shut thoughtfully.
If Mojag lends me a hand."
Mojag gave a wordless nod and climbed up to join Ansel at the long console where he sat, prodding boards awake.
"Time we got as close to the deck as possible," he told the others. "Don't want anyone copping a sprained ankle or worse."
Lying flat out, with his head propped up on one hand, Pike thought about Mojack. He was a skinny guy in his middle years, dark brown eyes and short brown hair lightened by encroaching greyness. He and the Kiskashian, Oleg, had only joined the crew a year ago, but the story went that back in his 20s, before he met Oleg, he had suffered head injuries so serious that nearly half his brain was replaced with a pseudo-organic cortical prosthesis. While the injury and subsequent operation erased great swathes of memory, the prosthesis permitted the replacement of fact and images as supplied by members of his family. Whenever the subject arose, Mojack insisted that before the injury, he had been something of a planet-skipping, bed-hopping playboy, a claim most of the crew found amusing, since the Mojack they knew was calm and meditative and self-possessed to the point of unreadability. Even now. Once everyone was on the deck, Ansel gave a 5-second countdown before bringing the grav system back online. The return of body weight elicited a collective oof. A moment before, the sound of crashes and clatters reverberated along the corridor outside and, undoubtedly, throughout the ship. "The sound of our worldly goods rediscovering which way is down," said Dervla as she got up on shaky legs. With a dry laugh, Pike forced himself upright.
"Right then, Ansel, can you activate some sort of comms?"
Sitting slumped in one of the bucket seats by the monitors, Ansel frowned.
"Without oversight from Scar, I might be able to rig an open channel using the Corridor Voca network. You might have to shout, though."
Scar was the name Pike had conferred upon the ship's AI.
"Aye, do it," Pike said. "We'll get Scar back online, and then maybe we can find out what's keeping the air breathable."
"Bet it's another legacy system," said Dervla. "You know, the stuff that Voth dealer promised that he'd wiped from the substrate notes. 6 years since you bought this heap, and we're still getting weird events like this."
"Well, aye, but this time it's kept us alive," he said.
"Perhaps yourself and Wynne could go up to the main hold and restart the enviros from up there."
"What about Oleg and Hamadi?"
"We'll deal with them once the Scarabus is up and running, and we have the sensors and weapons primed and ready. Not before."
Dervla regarded him. "Should we go to the bridge afterwards? Relight the boards?"
"No. I'm heading there myself in a moment or two."
He offered a thin smile.
"Get Scar woken up and bright-eyed."
"You and that AI are too close for my liking," she said, arching one eyebrow. With that, she headed out of the hatch, followed by Wynne, who smiled and rolled her eyes before leaving. Watching them go, Pike thought, "Well, if I didn't know any better..." He turned to the others. Mojack and Ansel were still working at their elevated workstations, prodding and flicking screen glyphs and webby data arrays. Krefom, the Hankayan, was doing stretching exercises to firm up his relaxed muscles, while the Agetzi, Punjo Bex, was still slumped on the floor by the wall. At 2.5 meters, he was average height for an Agetzi, a low-grav biped species whose homeworld lay in the Confederal Alliance of Fensar. Pike squatted down beside him.
"How are you doing, Puncho?"
"I have been without gravity-ness for some time, Captain," the Agetzi said in his soft, double-larynxed voice. "I am, with embarrassment, at my body's incapacity. I should be aiding the recovery of our vessel."
"Don't you worry yourself about that. You'll be right as rain in a short while. I just need to ask you something about when that whore and his goons came aboard. Did you sense anything from them at all? Any kind of threat?"
The Agetzi's narrow features were a picture of anguish. Pike had hired him 1.5 years ago on account of his voluminous knowledge of rare and valuable trade goods, especially arts and antiquities. He also possessed some low-level psi abilities that had proved useful now and then.
"Captain, I am with sorrow. I detected nothing from them, nothing at all. They were very calm."
"Might have been shielded,"
chipped in Ansel from above. or mind-trained, Pike said, frowning. Which would make for a very interesting skill set for a bunch of supposed smugglers. He patted Punjo on the shoulder and stood.
Look,
if they were able to shield their minds, then there was nothing you could have done. Doesn't matter how they did it. So don't be getting bent out of shape over it. All right? Punjo raised one long-fingered hand, reached inside his pale green overtunic, and took out a small dark blue pouch. He loosened its ties, opened it, and tipped out a number of small, intricately detailed figurines. Sorting through them, he picked out one and returned the rest to the pouch.
You are right, Captain, he said. I must winnow out the true guilt from the false, and in the enduring time regain my strengths. Gst will help me see the path.
Punjo was a follower of the Weave, a religion derived from the lives of 9 holy seekers who lived at a time when the Agetsi had reached a tribal level of development. Believers memorized the 3 catechisms, the 3 inspirations, and the 3 obligations, and carried on their persons a pouch containing effigies representing the 9 novices. The little figurines served as a focus for meditation on a wide range of topics, either on their own or in specific arrangements. Out of curiosity, Pike had once asked Punjo if he ever employed the effigies as stand-ins for the crew, but the Agetsi insisted that according to orthodoxy, such a use amounted to allegory and was therefore inadvisable. Pike wasn't sure how much of an answer that was.
Good, he said. And now I'm off to the bridge to get things humming there. Oh, and Cref, would you check the aft storage booths for breakages and damage? The sensors on some of the stacker bots are crocked, so we may have to straighten the booths out by hand.
I can do that, Captain,
Cref said.
There'll be some good lifting in that.
Pike grinned and left, following the starboard corridor to where a companionway led up to an off-deck up on a level with the high gantries that ran along either bulkhead of the main hold. A viewport gave a view down into the hold, where he could see Wynne Foskell inspecting the innards of a tall, hinged maintenance panel. Of Dervla there was no sign. Turning, he glanced at the smaller, thicker viewport in the bulkhead, which was part of the hull. There was only a dozen of them scattered around the Scarabus, and all were doubly sealed by the ship-wide shutdown. Getting them open again was high on his list, serving his need to see the stars. The Great Star Forest, as his Granny Reynolds used to call it, saying that there were many trails through the forest, and not all of them were safe.
Well, you were right enough there, Gran. If I ever get back to Cruachan, I'll have a few stories to tell you.
A couple of weak red emergency lamps scarcely pushed back the gloom on the bridge, otherwise broken by a scattering of glowing amber pinpoints. But Pike moved with the ease of familiarity from station to station, switching on the 6 retrofitted overhead holomonitors. Silver radiance lit up the vacant operator couches and patches of the deck, while the bright illuminance bloomed from console lamps and readouts as he started to bring the secondary systems online. Moving over to the command console, he sat in his battered leathery chair with the tilt-gimbaled drink holder and watched the system indicators go green on his main holoscreen and felt a measure of satisfaction. The Scarabus was a Type 38 Ombulan transport, well known for its ruggedness, but the modifications he'd put in down the years had changed it from a reliable workhorse into a tough, fast, multi-purpose vessel capable of giving as good as she got. Now she practically amounted to an extension of himself, and this ship-wide reactivation was like a part of himself reawakening. The AI, Scar, had not yet reached full-run status. From a standing start, it was always the slowest to reach functionality, but since most of the secondary systems were now online, Pike decided to unseal the viewports, starting with the ones on the bridge. 3-yard-long, foot-wide curves of lattice-toughened yew glass, capable of withstanding direct hits from pulse and beam cannon. Now, the outer seals retracted into their hull apertures, revealing the world they were orbiting. A large planet, banded in shades of dark blue and grey, and adorned with a thin and perfect, almost delicate-looking orbital ring. That's not Nadisha 2, he thought. I should be looking at a pale blue world in the grip of an ice age, not this, whatever it is.
Captain, where are we?
Wynn Foskell was standing in the entry hatch, staring in shock at the viewport. That's not the ice planet.
I know that, Wynn, Pike said calmly. Now, if you sit yourself down at the nav station, we'll work on finding out what the situation is. Okay?
Okay,
she said shakily, going over to one of the couches.
But that's a gas giant, and we were orbiting a Class P habitable before.
She was interrupted by a brief tinny fanfare.
At last, Pike muttered in relief, when I have a feeling that we're still in the same system, but I'm sure the experts can figure it out. Scar, you back in the saddle yet?
Hello, Bran. Cognitives are at 98%. Now at 100%.
Pike smiled. The AI's voice was composed and purposefully synthetic, yet with a feminine undertone.
Excellent, Scar. Priority request. Verify astrogational location.
Still trying to initialize main sensors, Bran. Crash power down has damaged several low-level data conduits. Sensors initialized. Scanning now.
Pike glanced over at Wynn and said, wait for it.
Astropositional anomaly, said the AI in a more urgent tone. Rebuilding stellar context array. Gathering system comparators. Matching with last known coordinates.
Bran, I can confirm that the Scarabus is still in the Nadisha star system. However, we are now 594 megaclicks from our original position in orbit around Nadisha 4, a mid-range gas giant.
What's our orbital status?
Ecliptical intermediate. High stability.
And just how long were we out? Pike said, thoughts racing.
17 hours and 24 minutes have elapsed since the crash power down event.
He uttered a low whistle. That's quite a span of time.
Whatever they were up to, they'll be long gone by now, I reckon.
Seated in her couch, Wynn Foskell looked over her shoulder at him.
Chief, I don't get it. If they wanted us dead, why not just blow the drives instead of hauling us halfway across the system?
Look at it from their twisted psychopathic side, he said. Those scum wouldn't have known what precautions we might have taken, or who knew we were coming here. Hey, Scar? Was the ship ident still active through all that?
Yes, Bran, it was.
Pike nodded.
Yes, they might have looked like lowbrow brutes, but they had some smarts among them. So, anyone who came looking for us would lock onto our ident, follow it here, only to discover that we were all victims of a tragic enviro system mouth, which would keep attention away from the planet we were originally orbiting.
He sat back in his high-backed couch, enjoying the creak of the blue tove leather as he thought for a moment, wondering why the ship had been moved and what might be happening back at their original location. Then he said,
Scar? What's our general status? Are we fit to fly?
Hull integrity is optimal, as are shields and secondary propulsion units.
He gave a little nod and leaned forward to prod up a comlink on the holoscreen.
Ansel?
In the holoscreen, Ansel Martell looked round.
Ansel, I'm thinking we should set a course back to that wintry world we were orbiting before. See if we can find out what happened to our cargo and that gang of scum-sucking jackers. How are the drives behaving?
Sweet as a bell, Chief. Field matrices should be ready in about 10 minutes. Will we, by any chance, be making a micro-jump?
That's my thinking, Pike said,
pausing when he realised that the seat next to Martell was empty. Where's Mojag?
Well, once the generators were up and running, everything was on track. Mojag knows his stuff, must have picked up a lot from, you know, Oleg. So he says he has to take care of his quarters, and I told him that's okay, because I'm on top of everything.
Ansel frowned.
He seemed quieter than usual, but not himself.
What do you mean?
When I glanced over a few times, I saw him shake his head slightly or make that agreeing sound he makes, but nobody was speaking to him. And once, I definitely heard him mutter to himself.
He shrugged.
Never saw him do that before.
Pike nodded. Mojag has a different load to carry than you or I. Got that chunk of hard mem in his head, which makes dealing with grief complicated.
Mojag is a very mellow fellow, said Ansel. He's usually a calming influence.
And I'm sure that in time he'll find a way to cope with his loss, Pike said. In the meantime, how are those fields coming along?
A few minutes yet, Chief. Then we can shake the dust and be on our way. Good man.
Then, sensing something, he spun his chair round to see Dervler watching him from the port side bridge hatch. You're really taking us back to the ice world, she said. Could be risky, going by what we've just been through.
I don't take kindly to being trussed and chumped by a bunch of over-muscled leather boys, he said.
Ah, so this is about your ego. Glad we're clear on that. Smiling, Pike poked one of the comm buttons.
Scar, set a micro-jump course back to Nadisha 2, if you please.
Yes, Bran. I shall be ready to commence a ship-wide 30-second countdown in 2 minutes.
Thanks.
He met Dervla's gaze. And no, my flower, this is not about my ego. I take on jobs for business reasons, not thrills, and I think I'm quite entitled to remedy the situation.
And get us into...
She shrugged. Okay, so what's the plan?
Well, as we are in possession of neither the comm scanner nor the payment we were due from that pus-stained core, the idea is to return to the scene of the crime and see what clues we can find. Iron trails, any stay-behind pieces, that kind of thing.
In the background, Scar's voice announced the imminent hyperspace micro-jump and started counting down.
So, we're going after the scumbucket, Dervler said, while not having any idea of what force he might have at his disposal. You know, there is such a thing as cutting your losses.
And there's such a thing as self-respect, he came back. In any case, we actually need the money to keep the Scarabus operational.
At that moment, the ship's hyperdrive kicked in, bending the subquantal structures of space-time in very specific ways. Pike felt the familiar squeeze vertigo effect as it swirled through him, but he only paused for a moment or two.
And it might be nice to buy some of that stuff they call food. I'm led to believe that it actually has a taste, unlike that cyclo rubbish we've been...
He stopped when Dervler, wide-eyed and uneasy, pointed over at the bridge viewports.
Is that... really?
Even as Pike swiveled his chair to look, the ship AI spoke.
Planetary anomaly detected. Stat conflicts across all main parameters. Full macro scan in progress.
Nadisha 2 was a pale blue world, its continents buried beneath snow and blizzards that weren't due to start receding for another half a millennium. But what Bran and Pike were seeing through the viewports was something completely different. A darkened world, swathed in angry cyclonic weather patterns. As he stared, he felt a strange urge to laugh.
Scar, where the devil are we looking at?
Scan results are incomplete, but preliminary assessment is confirmed. Although this planet occupies exactly the same orbital location as Nadisha 2 and possesses the same angular velocity, it is another planet altogether.
Pike nodded judiciously.
Well, you don't see that every day.